Very nice to be here. Thank you for having me. I heard that I'm the second speaker this year. People don't want to come because it's too cold. I will always come if you want me to come. So you always have a joker, don't worry. And so as you see, this is going to be about Higgs physics and its connection to the fermions. And so I decided to speak about this, not so much because, even though it's preliminary, not so much because it is such a groundbreaking thing, but because it is a very, very neat idea, I think. And I want to show you this. Maybe you're interested. And this is work done in collaboration with Gilad Perez, Yotam Sorek, and Kozaku Tobioka in Weizmann. And let me say that Higgs physics is at the moment for us a new window, so to say, to look for new physics. In the sense that we have seen no new degrees of freedom, but we have a new particle. And this new particle can have exotic couplings to what we expect from the standard model. So this is one direction which we can go in the future. And for sure, we expect much more from run two of LHC and the high luminosity LHC. So one interesting direction is to look at what we expect. I mean, what is the sensitivity that we expect in specific decays of this Higgs? So more specifically, we have the standard model. It works in a very, very good way. And in the standard model, the Higgs boson is being introduced for one very important reason, namely to unitarize WW scattering, and I mean, Gauge boson scattering. So its VEF then induces the W and the Z masses. And it's done in a very minimal way, in such a way that only one single degree of freedom needs to be included. So this is something that is qualitatively tested at the LHC by directly observing production of Higgs and then decay to WW and ZZ. So we already have a very good test from this, a direct constraint. And we already had very good indications about it coming from electroweak precision. Okay? So this is not what I'm going to talk about today. What I'm going to talk about today is the secondary role of the Higgs boson within the standard model. So within the standard model, the same way that the Higgs unitarizes WW scattering, it also unitarizes fermion-fermion to WW scattering. And in a very minimal way, the electroweak VEF gives the mass to the fermions, and the Yukawa couplings in the standard model control not only the masses, but also the CKM matrix. So this is a very big number of parameters. Okay? They're very small parameters because we observe many different large hierarchies in the spectrum. And so far, we have only observed the third generation couplings of the Higgs boson to fermions. So we know this.
Sure. The hypothesis of the PB bar is still not in great shape.
Yeah.
And this is dominant decay, 60%.
60%. And this is exactly what I'm going to talk about today.
The BB bar.
The BB bar. So I will talk about
Why is this?
No. I will always assume that they observe something that is standard model-like. I will not play the game of assuming some tension in the data. What I'm going to do is I'm going to try to interpret what they give us in terms of the Yukawa charm. This is what this is the aim of this talk. I will come to this. So the interesting part about, in this sub part here is that there's a lot of progress, both in the theoretical part, from the theoretical part, and also experimentally. Now, for the experimentalist, things look very different. He doesn't care if it's a boson or anything. He just knows that there's a particle, and this particle is defined by giving him the mass, the charge, the spin, and the couplings. So the mass has already been observed by the ATLAS and CMS collaborations, so it gives us a new parameter of the standard model. So it cannot we cannot find new physics by measuring the mass, unless, of course, this mass is so high that we have problems with unitarity. So with the mass that we're given, we just got back the standard model. The charge, we know that it's neutral. The spin is, we're nowadays pretty sure that it's spin 0. Maybe it's spin 2 is now it is spin zero, I think we can say this. So if we want to find new physics, we should look at the couplings. And the couplings are very well predicted within the standard model because we know the masses, and we know that the Higgs couplings to the fermions is always proportional to their mass. We've measured all the masses of the fermions in the standard model, so we know all the Higgs couplings. So this is an over-constrained system. And the interesting question to ask is whether these Yukawa couplings are actually, whether they can be not related to electroweak symmetry breaking. So this is our window for new physics. This is what I'm going to talk about. Now this is a little, this is all going to be very simple. So the first exercise is to look at Michael Peskin's talk from 2012, okay, he gives projections for the sensitivity that we're going to get at LHC and future colliders. These are all lepton colliders. So what you see here, the x-axis are just numbering, in principle, all the particles in the standard model that can couple to the Higgs. And here is the sensitivity that we have to measure in measuring their couplings. Okay, the different colors, okay, are different colliders. Okay, and as implied by the title, I want to focus on charm Yukawa. So you're going to see here that there's one purple line missing, namely on the charm. Okay, so this is exactly what I'm going to talk about. I want to find out what we know from LHC about the charm Yukawa. And for the rest of the talk, I'm going to build up to explain you what this plot is about. Right? So this plot gives you in the x-axis the mass of the fermions in the standard model. Okay, I have not written down explicitly the electron and the muon. And here it gives the Yukawa. Okay, so in the standard model, everything's totally clear. You have to sit on this line, right? And experimentally, we are sitting on the line to very good accuracy. However, when we actually measure something, we do not measure the Yukawa coupling, we measure signal strength. So we need to have some sort of interpretation in terms of Yukawa couplings. And I will focus on the charm, okay? And what I want to explain to you is this different coloring, okay? And how they are related, how robust they are, what is known directly, what is indirectly, what assumptions are made. So you're going to see, I'm going to tell you now what I'm going to tell you. So this is the red lines is going to be the global fit, so including all information we have. Okay. The green lines are going to be from the measurement of the total width of the Higgs. This is from some quarkonium production that I'm going to explain. And this is the neat idea that we had of recasting the Higgs to BB bar analysis. Any questions so far? Okay, so after a few introductory remarks, I will focus on charm Yukawa at LHC 8, and we'll start going through the constraints that I just mentioned. So the width of the Higgs, recasting the two measurements of mu b, the signal strength of Higgs to BB bar from ATLAS and CMS. I'm gonna mention what we learned from looking at quarkonium production in association with a photon. And then I will give the global analysis. And as a last step, I will include some future projections, mainly from LHC 14, high luminosity, so 3000 Uranus femtobarn, and we'll conclude. Okay, so this is perimeter, this is a very theoretical setup, so we can talk about unitarity bounds. And what is this? Well, as mentioned, we have WW scattering, and it gets unitarized by including the Higgs. So if I now change, if I do fermion-fermion scattering to WW, to the longitudinal modes, and I modify, I just go into the Lagrangian and brute force just change the coupling, that what I'm going to see is that this amplitude is going to explode at some point. Now, the difference with respect to WW scattering is that it doesn't go with the square root of S, but it goes with S. It's less suppressed, and it's also suppressed by the mass of the fermions. All right? So a very stretched but phenomenologically viable scenario is that actually the Higgs may not couple at all to the light fermions. as far as we know, this is fine. Okay, so in principle, they could obtain their masses from some hidden sector. I mean, in these RS models, it's, it wouldn't come from the superposition of the overlap with the Higgs field, but from some other source. And then this would mean that at some scale, unitarity would tell me that the theory is no longer is sick. Theory is sick. So I would have to include new degrees of freedom or have some non-perturbative dynamics. Now, if we play this game, what we find is that actually the scales at which unitarity, the unitarity bound scales, are totally inaccessible to current and, may I also say, future colliders. Okay? So we see here that for the bottom quark, it's around 200 TeV, center of mass energy. And it gets, of course, even worse with lighter quarks because it's inversely proportional to the mass of the fermions. This comes from the fact that when I do a W fermion to longitudinal Ws, I have to have, the Lorentz structure such that I have to flip the mass of the fermion and I get it in the amplitude. So it is true that at the LHC, we will probably not be able to see those new degrees of freedom if the Higgs would not couple to the light quarks. So the more promising direction is to look at setups in which the Yukawa couplings are enhanced. Okay. So if the deviations of the Higgs couplings to light quarks are small, so they're not amazingly big, then we can work in an effective field theory. So we can just take the unbroken standard model, the Lagrangian, and add dimension 6 operators, which once we would go to the broken phase would introduce modifications to the Higgs couplings. So the main dimension 6 operator that would contribute to this is given here. Okay? It has in total 3 Higgs boson fields. And from now on, I will now focus more on charm. Right? So charm is, okay, like all quarks, it's very challenging because it has a very small Yukawa coupling, approximately 4%, and its branching ratio to the branching ratio of Higgs to charm is also very suppressed, approximately 4%. However, there's something that is there to aid us, namely that the main decay channel of the Higgs is the bottom. Okay, is Higgs to BB bar is 60%, even though the Yukawa coupling of the bottom is also very small. Okay. This means that if I change a bit the charm Yukawa or change the bottom Yukawa, the phenomenology will change a lot. Okay. And so this has been discussed here. So starting from this Lagrangian, you can go to the broken phase. And then you immediately see how these modifications of the Higgs couplings comes to be. So you get one contribution when you insert both VEVs here. You get one contribution proportional to the mass. And you get another contribution proportional to the Higgs coupling, to the, what the experiments, so to say, measure. And they come with different factors here in front of this coupling G. And these authors have made the global fit. Okay, this global fit includes all information, and it's mainly dominated by the information we have about how much the Higgs goes to untagged or invisible partners. And they find that the scale at which we're probing is approximately, let's say, 25 TeV. And for this, they set this G coupling to be 16 pi squared for some reason. If they would set it to be 4 pi, it would be 8 TeV. Okay? So this is the sort of scales we're probing. We change Yukawa C by a factor of 2. Okay, and then we have some new physics at around this scale, let's say. Yes?
If the Higgs was a composite, then you would expect that the states at 125 GeV, namely pseudoscalar, would be a mix of pseudoscalar and scalar, potentially split 2. How do we know that's not true?
So, we don't know that this is not true. I mean, this depends on these composite models, on the Xi, right? On how much fine-tuning you allow in this setup. So how much you decouple exactly those resonances that you're saying from the lowest lying resonance, which is assumed to be the Higgs being a Goldstone boson. So I think it's
the
still...
Spin, mm-hmm. Determination of the spin is done by the root test. And it favors... the data. But there could be a mixing. It's not that you're not able to decide that. Hopefully, during the
show, and mixing with spin 2?
No, because we get higher luminosity. So,
mixing with spin 2 resonance?
The present data does not tell you that there's no mixing with spin 2.
This is true. It is going to be very hard to probe it, though, right? The direction that people are going is to look at the case, for example, of Higgs to tau tau, and try to look at the angular distributions of how the tau decays in order to get some feeling about what the axial component of the Higgs is. And in this case, you're talking about a different operator. This would be a different operator here.
Yeah, the pseudoscalar operator.
This would be the pseudoscalar, exactly, yeah.
So. Still possible that Higgs is a composite. This gets rid of the naturalist part of the region.
Yeah, it gets rid of the big naturalist problem. It introduces the little hierarchy problem, I guess, right? Yeah. Which is great.
Which is great.
Yeah. Which is great. All right. Okay. So what do we know so far? What we know so far is that the Higgs couples to third-generation fermions. Okay, so here it's a plot of the charges within the standard model. So here are the charged leptons, here are the down-type quarks, and here are the up-type quarks. And in logarithmic scale, they you cover within in the standard model. Okay, so in red are the measurements. Okay, what the experiment actually measure are signal strengths. This means cross-section times production times branching ratio normalized to the expectations of the standard model. So if everything's standard model-like, then the signal strengths will always be one. Okay? And here's the current knowledge that we have by averaging Atlas and CMS. You see here I did something. I averaged Atlas in CMS, and therefore you cannot see that Atlas has a bit of a fluctuation. But
we have to be careful about mixing up these things.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. So that's to be kept in mind. So Atlas has a 0.5 plus minus 0.8, I think, like this. But it's all well within 2 sigma. And what we also know, interestingly, is that the Atlas in CMS give us an upper bound on what the Yukawa of the muon and the electron can be. Okay? So they're not the lower bound. They can be. They have to be smaller than 7 or 3 times 10 to the 5 at 95% confidence level. So already this information is enough to say something about lepton universality, if you're interested in this. What I mean by this is you just divide the signal strengths of the muon with the tau. You get approximately 280. Okay. If the Yukawa of the muon is equal to Yukawa of the tau, and you see that the observation actually tells you that this needs to be smaller than 15, so you know that the Higgs does not couple universally to charged leptons. Okay, so that's good because as far as we know, all interactions that we know so far in the standard model, like gauge couplings, and they couple universally. Now we have a new interaction. It doesn't couple universally to different families. Okay, it's not the end of the world, but it's a nice statement. The other question we can ask is, what about quarks? Is it possible to make such a statement for quarks? And I will talk about this. And what you see here is that all light quarks, we have no information about light quarks, not about charm, and certainly not about the even lighter quarks. So what are the challenges? The challenges are clear. The branching ratios are tiny. Okay? And on top of this, we have a very large QCD background. So if I imagine that the Higgs decays to do light quarks, then I would have a diejet. And we know that the cross-section to diejets in the LHC is humongous. So we need some sort of flavor tagging. And we also need to suppress the backgrounds. And there are two different directions one can go. One direction is to be exclusive, so to choose a very specific mode in which the Higgs goes, okay, like a J-Psi or something like this, and to use this meson that comes out as a flavor proxy to tag, so to say, the flavor content of the flavor content from coming from the Higgs. Okay, so this is possible for up quarks, down quarks, strange quarks, and charm. And this is the paper that initiated this quarkonium search, and there's been more work done. And actually, ATLAS has already a search for this. So they give now this. It's from last month. They give a bound on the production times branching ratio. Or we can be more inclusive, which is good because we can increase the statistics. Okay, but then we are limited by the fact that we have to have some sort of B or C tagger. Okay, and as far as we know, so far, there's only B tagging information. Okay, and recently there's been impressive progress, especially in ATLAS. That was used in SUSY searches. So they have a working point where which they call seed tag, in which they can tag with a pretty good efficiency. I'm going to mention this now: 20% charms and reject many of the big quarks. Okay, so this is the ATLAS's charm tagging working point. You see, the efficiency of getting a charm is 20%, and 12% of this could be big quarks. And what they do is they look at, this is a very robust thing because they can calibrate using a huge number of events based on these stars. They use some multivariate techniques with information about the impact parameters and displaced tracks and topological properties and all this stuff. And with respect to the traditional working points for B tag, you get a factor of two rejection of Bs. So traditionally, there's the so-called medium-medium working point for B tagging, where you know that if you have a B quark, you have 70% chance of getting it, okay? And you have a 20% chance that you mistag a charm to be a B jet. This is what it means, okay? So you see here, it's much reduced. So this is essentially a C tagger. And they've already performed searches on this, okay? So they look for stops that decay to charm and neutralino, and they look for pair production of charms that go to charm and neutralino, which is a very interesting physics, because these are essentially searches for non-degenerative quarks, and we know that they have connections to naturalness. So we know that if there's large mixing between stop and charm, there's a possibility that searches are less sensitive to getting the stop mass, and then you can still have them light, and maybe it will help you for naturalness. So these are very interesting searches. I think it's 0.5%. I think it's 0.5% here. Yeah, that's very important to also keep it always low. All right, so now we'll go through the three things that we know. First, the Higgs, then the recast of H to BB bar, and then the exclusive decay measurement, okay? So the first and the most trivial thing to do is to just look at the results from ATLAS and CMS regarding the total width within the standard model, okay? So what they do is they make a shape analysis on the signal of Higgs to gamma-gamma and Higgs to ZZ. And they give bounds on the total width. Okay, this is an onshell width, so this is a very robust thing. This is like looking at Z at LEP. And you see here that you have 2 GeV, or let's say you have 2 GeV bound, whereas within the standard model you have 4 MeV. Okay, so it's ridiculously bad, so to say, and actually it will not improve much in the future because it's bound by the resolution of the experiment. So we cannot expect much improvement. However, we can play the game of completely saturating this whole width by increasing the charm recovery. by doing this, for sure, we're going to get a bound on the charm you cover. Okay? So the bound we get is that the charm you cover should be smaller than 100, 150 times the value within the standard model at 95% confidence level. Okay? So this is step one. No. Yes?
Gamma if I exit two photon, if you work it out, it's about 31 keV.
The gamma what?
Higgs into two photons.
Yes.
The gamma.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's about 30 keV. Let's work it out from the standard one. So it's interesting. It's so small compared to the actual width. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
This is your point. I mean, these widths are very small. The gamma's decay rate. So. A lot of stuff can be hidden in there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you see, this is a... I mean, I can enhance the charm you cover by 200.
Yeah.
This is... this is almost the top quark, right? Right?
So my question is, when will we know more about this?
I think from this measurement, we will not know more.
This is not good.
Yeah, good or not. I mean, if the resolution of the experiments cannot improve...
Yeah. Means there's a lot of stuff going on in there.
But we have also other handles. We also know more about the total width, right? We can do something like proton-proton collisions, and then we can get Higgs decaying to WW, okay? And this is controlled by one coupling, okay? By the coupling of the Higgs to Ws. Okay, this is vector boson fusion, and then the Higgs decays to vectors. So you know everything. I mean, assuming that you assume some standard model coupling for this Higgs to WW, then you measure this, and you know that the branching ratio is one decay rate that you have measured over total width, and this tells you something about the total width.
Same for the set.
Yeah, and the bond you get there is amazingly good. You get something that the total width should be smaller than six times the width within the standard model.
Set star.
Yeah. But it's less robust, right? I mean, this is the most robust thing we can do. Then I have to assume some kappa V. And so on. OK, so here's the idea. The idea is that B jets are not B quarks. It's very simple. So what does this mean? This means that we have a bit tagging, and once the bit tag tells us that this is a bit jet, we sort of assume that this means we have a bit quark, an underlying bit quark. Well, how does this bit taggers work? What happens is that the bit quark hadronizes to a B meson. Okay, the B meson is pretty long-lived, so 400 micrometer per second. Okay, so it can actually fly in the detector before it decays and gives us secondary and third and secondary vertices and third. Vertices. So this is what you see in this picture. Okay. So you have the primary vertex, the B hadron flies, it decays to a charm, okay, and the charm goes then to strange quarks and so on. Right? However, D mesons are also pretty long-lived. Okay. So this is we're talking about factor of four or three, so between 120 to 310 micrometers per second. So some C quarks are actually flying here and get identified as being B hadrons. Okay, so this is exactly the mistag that I was referring to before. Okay, now this mistag depends a lot on the working point for these B taggers. Okay, so what they actually do is they have a beast of multivariate analysis where they plug in some input and they find out whether this is now a B jet or not. So there are many different ways of doing it. So the collaborations actually do have some choice in which working points they choose. Okay, and this is represented here. So this is the CMS study for B tagging based on 7TeV data. What you see here are two plots. Both have the B jet efficiency, so the efficiency of tagging a B, in the x-axis. And on the y-axis, you have the probability of mistagging a charm here, or a light quark to be a B jet, okay? And the different colors are different multivariate techniques, okay? that they use. We don't care about this. What we care is this one working point that they have. And CMS explicitly uses this what they call CSV working point. And what happens is that typically, because you want to have as many bquerks as bjets as possible, you sit somewhere around here. So between 5 to 0.7, okay, efficiency to get the bjet. And similarly, you have the same for light quarks. Okay, and you see that if I sit here, and I go to CSV, I have approximately 1%. That's this point, that's the 5 per mil I was referring to before. So the experimenters have a choice of choosing different working points. And we know, you know this already, because I told you before that there's this seed dagger in Atlas in CMS where it has a completely different structure, right? So Atlas has managed to completely break this correlation between bjet and cjet using the simulation. In reality, of course, this correlation here is more complicated. There is a dependence on the PT of the jet. There's a dependence on the rapidity, probably also on the channel. But we will work based on this. And what the experiments actually do is they do give us exactly the working point. So they say, I'm doing this analysis, and the bjets that I'm identifying have this efficiency, and the C tag rejection factor is this, and the light quark rejection factor is this. So we know this. So is there a bound that I can get for the charm you cover coming exactly from this probability of mistagging the charm? Okay. So I will look into the two analyses of Atlas and CMS, okay, in which these are Higgs to BB bar analysis. And in the Higgs to BB bar analysis, what's special is that the Higgs is always produced in association with either a Z or a W. So this is the production channel that we have. Okay, and the experiments, they do an amazing job. They have different decay channels for the vector. Okay, the vectors can either decay to no charge leptons, Z nu nu, or to two leptons, or the W, of course, the W goes to one lepton. And so they have different channels for this, and they also have different categories based on the PT of the vector, the PT of this vector here. And what they also need to be sure is that they have big jets here, right? So they have to apply demand to B tags. Okay, and the interesting part is that the B tag working point depends both on the channel and the category. So Atlas has two working points and CMS has in total 4. So then what do? They define, now this is the full signal strength, right? So they say signal strength is defined as the number of events I observe over the number of events I expect, which is given by this formula, right? So this is the luminosity, it will cancel. This is the production cross-section in this imaginary new physics scenario and the standard model. Then I have the decay of the Higgs to, so this is the branching ratio of the Higgs to B with respect to the branching ratio of the Higgs to B in the standard model. And then I have additional efficiency corrections, right? So I have the efficiency of tagging the 1B, the efficiency of tagging the B, the second B, and also efficiencies, extra efficiencies, how much I lose from my signal, essentially. Okay, so after you cancel everything, you are left with a very nice formula that we know of, right? And what they do is they use these multivariate techniques to find the best discriminants of S over B in order to make their analysis as sensitive to deviations as possible, okay? So then what they do is they have all this boosted decision tree output, okay? It tells them, it gives them some number, they bin this number, and they make a chi-square, assuming that under this assumption here, okay? And they find the signal strength, okay? This is the deviation that you were referring to, right? So Atlas finds 0.52 plus minus 0.4, and CMS is right on spot, 1.0 plus minus 0.5. Someone said before that CMS is not good? Who said that? 1.0. So.
That's a joke.
Yeah, it's as good as 1.1, I guess. So from these signal strengths, we can get some information about the UCAV of the bee. Now, what will happen if the charm UCAV is modified by a lot, right? Because we actually don't know anything about the UCAV of the charm except for this 150. So can we say something about this? Well, in this case, we would have two signal strengths to play with, right? We have two parameters that we want to float. Okay. So this is now the modified signal strength. And you see what the modification happens. So the number of expected events is the same as before, okay? But now the observed event, okay, is the cross-section of producing the Higgs, which is the same in both cases, times the branching ratio of the Higgs to going to Bs, times the B tag efficiencies, plus production of the Higgs times the branching ratio to CC bar, times the efficiency factors for mistagging a C to be a B, right? Good. So this just translates to this formula here, okay? And this is a very simple formula. You see here that we need to fit for two signal strengths, mu b, and this is the traditional mu c signal strength. So it would be production times branching ratio over production times branching ratio with respect to the standard model from C. Okay, this is how I normalized here. And what you see is that typically, of course, you really want to have just b's. So the smaller this epsilon cb is, the better for you, right? You're less sensitive to mistag, okay? But if we actually want to play the game of getting some sensitivity on the charm you cover, then it actually helps us when this thing here is larger and larger, okay? Now, of course, if I have one working point and I make a global, and I make a chi-square fit, then I can only constrain this combination. So I don't gain anything, okay? So it is essential to get some sensitivity on both mu b and mu c to have different working points, okay? So there need to be different working points for this epsilon cb. That's why I made all this introduction, efficiencies, and so on, okay? The more different, the better, because I'm gonna have some flat direction, as I'm gonna show you now, and I need another flat direction to constrain.
One, two, which is coming up.
No, don't tell me this yet. I mean, it's coming. It's a very nice plot.
We have much better statistics.
3,000 events from the
bar.
Absolutely, but I will not tell you yet. I will tell you in a bit. It's coming. This is my preliminary result. It's very nice. It's very nice. It's okay. I can tell you now. It's plus my. I can tell you now. It's plus minus 14.
Plus or minus?
14.
14.
Plus
you
minus 14.
Anybody.
Yeah. It's very neat. It's very neat. Okay. Okay. So what do they have to do? We go to the paper, the experimental papers, right? We look at their plots because they give no tables, and we see this sort of plots. Okay, in the x-axis, you have some unphysical parameter. This is the outcome of this BDT, of this boosted decision tree. Okay, and here you have some arbitrary y-axis in terms of events. But what this plot actually gives you is it gives you in these bins, okay, it gives you the signal. This is the red line. Okay, it gives you the data, which is the little points here. Okay. And here it gives you the data over prediction, so you can get the background out of the ratio, or you read it off here, okay? So each bin is one independent variable, one independent measurement. It can be treated as one independent measurement, okay? And the bitter reality is that they do not give tables, okay? So, when I will show you my signal strengths, you can always say, but actually it's going to be better because I will not have to digitize, okay? But we digitize twice, and we're within 10% of each other. So this is pretty good. So this is not taking, I mean, we're not include this 10% error, but okay. Okay, so this is one plot. So then you go to Atlas, okay? And they have 12 plots, okay? So you go there, and you start digitizing with 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, once you're done, you say, I guess CMS is gonna be easier. No, they have more plots, okay? So you go here, you digitize. Okay, and having digitized all this, we can do exactly what Atlas and CMS do, okay? So we make a chi-square fit assuming only mu b, okay? And we manage to actually reproduce their signal strength, okay, up to 10%. So both the central value and the error. So we're pretty safe. It's not completely stupid what we're doing. And what is important is that as theorists, we don't know how to treat the systematic uncertainties, because the systematic uncertainties is input to the boosted decision tree. So I have no handle on this, okay? The fact that I managed to reproduce the error, okay, the only error that I have is my statistical error from Poisson statistics. The fact that I managed to reproduce the error means that we're completely dominated by statistics. So this is why this is safe. And exactly because we do not have control over all these large uncertainties in background-dominated regions, we, so to say, brute force apply the cut of S over B larger than 2.5%. So what this means is that we're very often in this areas here where the signal is larger than the background. Okay? The experimental collaborations don't have to do this, right? Because they know exactly what their uncertainties on the backgrounds are. And they can take all those bins into account. They do take all those bins into account. Okay, so this is now the recast. Now I'm making the chi-square fit. Okay, with two independent variables. Okay, this is now starting with Atlas. Okay, so you see Atlas has two working points: the medium-medium and tight-tight. Okay, so tight-tight has a smaller epsilon c over b. Therefore, it's this line. You see, you get no sensitivity in mu c, right? Because wherever you are, mu c is just fine, the signal strength of mu c. Now, if you go to medium-medium, which is now larger, then you sort of, the flat direction is tilted, okay? Okay, so then we can include also CMS. So CMS has four flat directions. So these are given here, tuck, 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 okay? And you make them the global fit. Okay, and you're left with 95 and 68% confidence level here. Now, if you want to know something about the signal strengths, you need to profile over mu b. So, yeah, this means essentially what this means is you make the chi square equal 2 here, and this is the two sigma region for mu c once you project on mu c. Okay, and profiling over this gives us the first bound on the signal strength of mu c. So this is a new result. What you see here is that mu c is 90, okay, plus minus 80 or 100. Okay, so not very good, right?
So you're not using the positivity of mu b and mu c
here? Here, no, because there can be background fluctuations, right? Data fluctuations. And essentially, I'm not imposing it, yeah. You think it should be imposed?
Mm-hmm. Off the top of my head, I don't remember, but I think there are ways to tell there are backgrounds that can be positive or negative, as you're saying, but there's a physical prior with the quantity of the cross that the branching ratio is not negative.
Sure, sure.
Clearly, if you assume mu b, you said, well, mu b has to make up some of the signal, some positive amount of the signal they see.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So I'm going to impose this in a sense in the next slide when I'm going to look at the coupling.
Okay.
Because there, in the coupling, it's more clear what the positivity constraint is, right? Because you have the coupling, and if you fit for the coupling instead of mu c, then per definition, it's not allowed to go negative. I'm coming to that.
Okay.
So if I assume no modification of production, okay, even if I assume Higgs decaying to CC bar at 100%, this would give me mu c equal 33, okay? So my bound from my previous bound would be completely trivially satisfied. I've said nothing new, okay? However, if YC over YC standard model is approximately 100, a new production kicks in, okay? So this is from Chams in the PDF, okay? So this is a new VH production mechanism. Okay, and what the plot that you see here is this modification of YC over YC standard model, and here's the ratio of standard model production, new physics over standard model production on VH. Okay, And the different lines is something important in the sense that because they have different channels, okay, every channel has a has different cuts, okay, depending on the PT of the vector and so on. So also the enhancement is different. Okay, so this is something we need to take into account. And this is when now the magic happens, because if I do this, okay, I can now take the mu B, mu C plot that I had before and interpret it in terms of Yukawa's. Okay, and what you see here is exactly this interpretation. So here is kappa C and here is kappa B. And the standard model is definitely here. So it's 1-1. And now let's see what happens if we keep the Yukawa of the bottom to be the standard model 1 and start increasing the charm Yukawa, right? So I'm sitting here and then I increase the charm Yukawa. Now, since I increase the charm Yukawa, I start losing BB bar events because I increase the width, okay? So I'm getting more and more constrained, okay? I'm getting excluded. You see, it's getting gray. I'm getting excluded. However, at some point around 100, the new production kicks in, okay? The new production kicks in and it starts creating more Higgses than I had before, okay? So this sort of compensates itself, okay? And I'm again back into the game, okay? So this is what you're seeing here. And you see that after profiling, you would get a bound on YC. This is opposite, no? YC over YC standard model to be smaller than 240, okay? The Higgs width was 150 from before. So I'm coming to that, okay? So this is one thing. The other way to say something about the charm Yukawa is to go the exclusive way, okay? In the exclusive way, you look at Higgs that decays through the charm Yukawa to CC bar. It gives a photon, and then this CC bar here becomes a J psi, okay? And there are two amplitudes, and it's very important that they interfere with each other, right? So we have this amplitude, excuse me, and the Higgs to gamma-gamma, where the gamma goes to the J psi. Okay, this is the only modification that I'm allowing, and these authors here found out what the partial width is, and the recent ATLAS study actually tells us production times branching ratio, tells us that it needs to be smaller than 33 femtobar. So what we can do is, because you know this is production times branching, I don't know what this is in terms of Yukawa of the charm, I can cancel the production by taking something I know, namely the production times branching ratio of the Higgs to ZZ star. Okay? So by doing this and by making the assumption that kappa V, so this is the modification of the coupling of the Higgs to WW, to be 1, which is a very robust statement. It comes from LEP. These authors here have talked about this. I can get a bound on kappa C. Okay? This is the bound I get. Okay, so now I can put everything together. Okay, and this is the combination. So this is the important plot. So here is the kappa C again, like before, and kappa B, right? Here is our recast, okay? It tells us that I need, for kappa C, I need to be below 240, okay? Then this J psi gamma bound, okay? So you understand, this here is a naive theoretician's recast of an analysis, one second. And this is the J psi measurement. So we are actually, we are, in a sense, competing with them. Yes?
Can you explain a bit better where does the left bound of kappa B come from?
On kappa B?
Kappa V.
Kappa V. So having... But given that they know the mass, they can interpret the E plus E minus to Higgs, no? To WW. And I mean, okay, I admit I'm not so familiar with their analysis, the Falkowski-Riva analysis.
I assume, yeah. I was just curious, okay? So I don't know what the function was. I'm just curious to see because it's actually a very impressive number that they give.
Actually, in a sense, I also know it from LHC, right? If I assume,
I mean, Stefania, do you know? No, I want to ask the same question. Yeah, okay, yeah. I mean, if we assume a measurement, Yeah, and I remember, yeah, but that has also pliers too.
Yeah.
Actually, there are some people that claim that the W is constrained better than number 10, but that has pliers.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, the
model. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, please carry on.
Okay. And the last line is this total width numbers that I had before, right? So at the moment, the best constraint we have is actually coming from this very bad resolution of the width. Okay, so this is what you find here. All right.
So what's the bottom line? The blue box is the standard model.
The blue, yeah, that's true. So
what are we, what's, is this good or bad?
There's no good or bad. There's no good or bad. The interesting part is going to come when I do the global fit, right? So if the global fit is telling me that kappa c is much, much smaller than the 150 bound I get here, I need to ask myself, is this possible? Is it even possible that this makes that this gives me new information? And there's one way that it's possible. I'm going to say it. So. Is there any way to make statements about up-quark universality? Well, we can look at the TTH analysis, which essentially measures the Yukawa of the top. Okay. So this is how it translates, right? You get the modification of the top Yukawa is given by, you plug in the numbers for production, square root of a branching ratio of Higgs to the relevant modes with respect to the ones that you have. Okay. This is for sure. Larger than one, so this is 0.9, okay? And if I combine all the bounds from the width and before, I find that the charm you cover needs to be smaller than the top you cover. Okay, so we had a trivial statement before that the leptons don't, the Higgs doesn't couple universally to leptons. We can make a similar statement now for the up-type quarks. Okay. And now this is the global fit. This is what I want to explain you from before. So now we know what this is, right? So the red line is when I vary all parameters on the standard model. Okay? The blue line is this recast bound that I have. The J-psi is the orange one, and the green ones, which is the better ones, are the width, right? So now this is your question, right? You're saying the global fit tells me something much better. It tells me that Yukawa of the C is approximately 6 times the standard model. Okay. And I'm telling you that the direct bounds, the very robust direct bounds I have, are orders of magnitude away. Okay? Is it possible that, is there any reason why I should not trust the fit? No, there's no reason not to trust the fit. However, there's one thing to keep in mind. Okay? The fit is completely dominated by untagged Higgs decays, which are driven by VBF production. Okay? So this means that I take VBF, vector boson fusion, I get a Higgs. So I get a kappa v, the Higgs decays to WW, I get a kappa v to the power of 4, and then I get the widths in the denominator. Okay? So by measuring the signal strength, I get a very strong bound on the total width of the Higgs, okay, under these specific assumptions of kappa v being 1, which tells me that the total width is actually needs to be smaller than 4 times the width in the standard model, and not this. This very large width that I had before, okay? So this is what's driving the global fit. So if you want to somehow break the global fit and say something more about it, then you need to find a new production mechanism that would give you VBF and it's not included in the fit. Actually, there is such a thing, okay? But it's insufficient. So I could enhance the Yukawa of the light quarks, okay? But at 8 TV, the change I'm going to get is nothing. So this will not help me. It is possible, however, to see some deviations if I go at 100 TV collider, okay? And then, okay, because I have up quarks in the PDF and down quarks in the PDF, I can get some 10% effects by taking the up quark you cover to be like the big quark you cover. This is the normalized. So there is a sort of interplay between different colliders, because if they were both lepton and hadron colliders, I could find the signal strengths, divide with each other, and get some sensitivity on light quark Yukawas, but not based on the decay, because the decay is going to be the same, but based on production. But this is not the way to go. The same also holds for VH production. Okay, so this is the ratio and the enhancement of VH for 100 TeV. This is for W and this is for Z, and this is the dependence on the PT of the vector. Imaginary world, right? So, coming to the future. The future looks bright. So here I'm taking the Atlas study for 14 TeV. This is what they did. And to take their 3,000 inverse femtobarn simulation of background and signal. Okay, this is a study based on the medium working point for B tag and C tag efficiencies. Okay, and if I want to interpret this in terms of mu C and mu B, I need two working points, right? So I'm taking those signal and background, and I'm rescaling with efficiencies to get a different direction. And once I do this, this is the plot I get, and now things look much better, right? So here I don't have now the 250, I had something like 50, and the signal strength I'm gonna get has an error of 14 for mu C. So this is the answer to your question from before, right? So at LHC 8, with current data and our little recast, we get 90 plus minus 80. And we expect to have something like 1 plus minus 14 at 3,000 inverse femtobarn. Okay? And actually, this is conservative, because like before, they did not give the tables for their BDT thing. Okay? So I could not apply the signal over background cut that they have. So it may be even a bit better. Okay. One last thing I want to say is the light quark Yukawas. Because I focus so far on charm quark Yukawas, and there's been recent progress also for light quark Yukawas. And what we can do is we could take the global fit and make a global fit either by assuming that one light quark Yukawa changes or by allowing everything to float. Okay? And these are the bounds we get normalized to the bottom of the bottom quark Yukawa in the standard model. Okay, so you see that for light quarks you can have a the up quark Yukawa can be as big as the bottom Yukawa, right? And this is still not excluded from the standard model. It's a very large modification. So this is from this work, and there's also a less robust bound from FCNCs, less robust because it comes from indirect constraints. So large enhancements are thermologically viable, and the idea of these authors were to generalize this quarkonium idea from Petriello and et al. To all other mesons. So what you do is you have those two amplitudes, right? From here, you need to have some information about how those CC bars, how often the CC bars go to JPSI. The correct language to do this is this light cone distribution amplitudes. For the gamma-gamma, we can use more data because we can look at data where the gamma goes to the corresponding meson and extract information. So the idea was to search for exclusive decays of the Higgs, Higgs going to phi and a gamma or rho to a gamma, and then use this as a proxy to get some information about the Yukawas. Okay? Now, what is very important is the level of interference. Go one slide back. Because this guy here is very, very small. It's 10 to the minus 11. So the only way for me to get a sensitivity is by summing them up and taking the square and looking at the interference, because then it's linearly proportional to the Yukawa instead of quadratically. And for this reason, and because they also looked at the backgrounds, these authors find that the most promising decay is the Higgs to phi and a gamma, where the QCD backgrounds are negligible. And they make a little study based on 3,000 inverse femtobarn, giving the sensitivity of those kappa Cs. What you see is that for a 100 TeV collider, we could get as close as six times, we could get sensitivity to something as close as six times the Yukawa of the strange. So this brings me to my conclusions. So there's been a lot of progress in extracting white charm, both from theoretical point of view and from experimental, because of the C tag from Atlas. And there are complementary approaches. There's the inclusive way, which seems to be very promising at the LHC, but maybe less promising for light quark Yukawas. And there's the exclusive one, where I look at specific decay, and therefore I reduce the backgrounds. Our theoretician's recast gives us that the kappa C needs to be smaller at 246 45. Based on current available data, no projection here. And we can expect something like delta mu approximately 14 at LHC14 with 3,000 events femtopan. The sensitivity is probably higher than anticipated from projections before the LHC, so there's been a lot of progress. And the last thing to say is that light quarks you cover us may be probed in exclusive decays since we have no corresponding tagger. So the conclusion is that there's a lot of hidden information in the current available data set, and there's more to come. So there's a lot to do there. And there's still room for new physics in Higgs decays. So the last question is, of course, whether the Higgs is actually responsible to giving the masses or not. Thank you. No, this is.
So that plot you show that had all
the. Yes.
Okay.
I think this recast is never going to be able to compete with this invisible decay.
I see. So.
But I have not done it, so. After including everything,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I'm for the same for LHC 14 with 3,000
units. And no, we're studying this at the moment.
Wow.
Yeah, that's our job, right? Because they have done it only for delta mu b, for mu b, not for mu c.
One more question. Have you guys thought about what new physics of model building? Have you guys thought about what type of physics you could get? Modify these coupling by so much without appearing anywhere else?
Yeah, that's of course a difficult question to answer. Now, if you take some vector-like quarks and you integrate them out at a heavy scale,
yeah,
you would get this dimension 6 operator.
Yeah, but that would be suppressed by the mass of those quarks.
Yeah, okay, sure. Yes.
Standard Yukawa equation is classic. It doesn't predict the Fermion mass spectrum. So there are ways of getting Fermion masses from quantum field theory calculations.
But it's three parameters, no? Huh? It's three parameters.
Yeah, well, this has been known for a long time. And,
but the top quark could be lighter, right?
Well, you can, this goes back to the 70s, calculating the masses of the fermions from the standard model using quantum field. That would show that it's in your. So if the Higgs is not responsible for light quark masses, this could enter into the picture. We want it to predict the fermion masses, not just put them in by hand.
So the standard model is not a model of flavor, right? So the Yukawa couplings and the masses are free parameters. You can do flavor model building, and then you can do some U1s at some high scale, Frogant-Nielsen, to get exactly the hierarchies and so on. But this is not the standard model.
No, it's a different model.
Okay.
But it's connected to the standard.
Mm-hmm.
One other question is, they've observed exciting mesons with Charles spectra.
Mm-hmm.
Spectroscopy. JPC is 1++. They don't fit into the quark model. Do you have anything to say about that? They have 12 sigma, but they're not going away. There are seven charged in it.
And the dynamics are under control there?
There are speculative theories that you have quark molecules, I think.
Okay, so then I would for sure not use them here, right?
You what?
I would not use them here to extract some parameters.
No, you couldn't use them here.
They are produced very rarely?
They're up to 12 sigma, no, so the cross-section discovery, so they're not going away. They have to be considered.
Mesons, not baryons?
Yeah. Interesting. Look at the physical relatives.
I will.
Yeah.